Before we get to the podcast, I wanted to make sure that you knew that my online knee course with Lenny Macrina is on sale for $200 off this week. If you want to learn exactly how to evaluate and treat the knee, you're going to love our comprehensive course where we cover our clinical examination, exercise progressions, and specific information on ACL, meniscus, patellofemoral, articular cartilage, osteoarthritis, and so much more. Plus, you can earn a ton of CEU credit. The course is on sale this week for $200 off. Head to mikereinold.com/knee for more information and to sign up today. On this episode of the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast, I'm joined by Steve DeShavi. Steve's a former PT-ATC working in the NHL with the Florida Panthers. He's now an assistant professor in the Department of PT and director of rehab in the Department of Athletics at High Point University. In this episode, we're talking about dynamic valgus control, Steve's concept of pelvic pronation, and how we can build better programs to reduce ACL injuries and rehab things like patellofemoral pain and hip femoral acetabular impingement. Welcome to the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Reinold from MikeReinold.com. Hey, Steve, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Mike, great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Tell me a little bit, fill me in a little bit. So obviously, you and I have known each other for years. We've been colleagues through the interwebs, we'll say, for years, but just, you know, had mutual respect for each other. I remember obviously back when you were working with the Florida Panthers in the NHL, which I'm sure was a really awesome experience. Tell me a little bit about what you've been up to since.
Yeah, so I left the Panthers now about 8 years ago and joined High Point University. We're about an hour and a half west of Raleigh, a small university, private university. I have a split appointment there. I teach in our PT curriculum, as well as I'm the director of rehab in our Department of Athletics. So responsible for mostly our more complicated post-operative rehabs. I touch base on most of the operative cases and then help mentor some of the athletic trainers, some of the ones that are still earlier in their career. So it keeps my hands sharp clinically. I get over there a couple days a week, and then the other 3 days I'm knee deep in our DPT curriculum trying to help the students eventually pass their boards first and foremost. And I always try to steer them in your direction because you're such a, and a thank you for that, for being such a great mentor to early learners and helping them get a foot in the right direction, especially those interested in sports PT.
Yeah, awesome. So quite a transition, which I think was pretty neat, right? Coming from the pro sports model to now this dual teaching professor type position, as well as clinical director with a lot of athletics. This seems like, you know, a really cool transition for you. And it sure seems like to me, from following you online, that this has spurred quite a few research questions in your head, right? And you can, I like taking snapshots of researchers, right? If you go to PubMed and you type in somebody's name and you actually look at what they're doing, you start to see some themes appearing, right? It's not just like a random study here and there, but there's a theme appearing. But tell me a little bit about your research progression the last few years, what you've been doing to build that up.
Yeah, I like the way you frame that. It is really interesting to see how people land in research and what kind of lens and bias they bring into that realm. And I'm no different. Leaving pro sports, as you know, from your time in pro sports and continuing to still work in that arena, the problems often come in really complex. But when you turn to the research as a clinician, you're hoping for all this help, that you're going to be able to find some answers to all these really complex questions. And I think that's where the ball started rolling for me in pro sports. And I had been adjuncting in a PT program at the time. So had always kind of really wanted to pursue my PhD and try to become more of a clinical scientist. I felt like I could hold my own as a clinician, especially in sports PT, but I really wanted to try to pursue that idea of putting some of my questions to the ultimate test, do some of the ways we really, really like to practice, and do some of my biases hold up to the scientific method. So I think that's what I was really going for when I was transitioning from pro sports into academia.
which is neat. And I think if you've listened to this podcast now, you see that I try to incorporate a lot of what I consider clinical researchers, right? That people that have clinical questions and then seek to answer them with the research studies. And I think that, to me, brings more impactful research a little bit. So again, that's why I'm drawn to a little bit of what you've been doing. It looks like a lot lately you've been focusing on is on the topic of pelvic control, right? So, you know, I guess you come from the hockey world, so that may explain some of it, but what got you into this specifically, looking at some of your research on the pelvis?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that bias of trying to understand the hockey stride and spending over a decade in the NHL really was the driver for some of my interest in the hip pelvis region. But interestingly, and you'll like this, when I first started out in corporate PT, my first assignment was working with a farm team for the Blue Jays. And at the time, you got put on a team and you were on a knee team or a hip team or... So I ended up on the shoulder team for a minor league baseball program. And I'd always been, as an athletic trainer and a PT, I've always had some field coverage, some strange in that way. My entire career, I've had time in the clinic and time on the field. And then it was time in the clinic and time on the ice. And now it's time in the clinic and time in the training room. So I've always been able to use my ATC kind of skill set. But transitioning from those baseball players and then transitioning to hockey was really fascinating, starting to see the connections, not just structurally ball and socket and things like that, but the development of energy through the kinetic chain and how things actually go from propulsion to deceleration and shock absorption and so on. I was fascinated by, I was really nervous maybe going into the NHL thinking, you know, I was a recreational hockey player at best. And, you know, you have to have a very intimate understanding of the biomechanics when you decide to go into a sport. And I had already been doing some hockey rehab for the Panthers in the clinical setting before I joined the team full time. So I was really able to take a deep dive into kind of hockey biomechanics. And that's kind of where my fascination started. And then initially that light bulb went off and I said, I probably know a lot more than I think I do because of all these relationships to the upper quarter, which really kind of fascinated me at first. So then jumped in full time with the team. And now you're on a daily basis, and you know this more than anybody. You can't hide from anybody. Practice, travel, dinner, you're seeing the same players over and over and over and really trying to sharpen that skill set to solve all these difficult problems. I think that hip-pelvis connection is really where I started scratching my head saying, okay, how do we solve some of these problems? And if it is like the shoulder, how would we apply some of the same kind of clinical research, because I don't think the clinical research at the hip and pelvis is at the level in terms of volume. And it is now. It's definitely more common in the last 10 years as we've seen that switch from shoulder scopes to hip scopes, right? The statistics are actually pretty similar. So we've all had to up our treatment IQs with regard to hip scopes and so on. But that's when I really started to have and develop these clinical questions specific to the hip and pelvis.
And I think the questions that you've come up with are fantastic, right? They're some of the questions that many of us are probably asking ourselves. One area that you've drawn attention to lately is dynamic knee valgus. And you actually had a piece in JOSPT, and I'll put this in the show notes. But, you know, you called out the concept that I really like the way you said this, is that we should probably be focusing more on controlling valgus instead of preventing it or avoiding it completely. And, you know, I think you got a little heat over this, right? You could probably elaborate on that a little bit too. So, and I get it because, it's subtlety. I read the article and I know exactly what you were saying, but sure, there's some people that are going to take that to either extreme and probably take it too far, right? But the concept of controlling valgus versus avoiding it, you tell me a little bit about that and a little bit about, you know, the research that you put into that.
We'll be back after a quick break.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast episode. If you want to learn more from me, please check out my website, mikereinold.com. In addition to all my great articles, videos, and podcast episodes, I have a ton of online CEU courses, as well as my Inner Circle online mentorship and community. Be sure to subscribe to my free newsletter, where I'm always sending you great info and exclusive perks and discounts. Just head to mikereinold.com to get started. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and that was a it's easy to look back on it now because that was 19, and then in 2017 we published a paper in BJSM that talked about rehabilitating overhead throwers. And we were looking at, and you were actually cited in that paper, and we actually were looking at how high of evidence do we have to support rehab for an overhead athlete. And what we found was there is this level one, or the higher levels of evidence don't nearly come to match the complexity of the task. So we saw that single plane exercises, particularly for external rotation concentrically below 90 degrees, was one of the most highest exercises that are researched for an overhead athlete. And any clinician would say, well, that really doesn't look like the task. And where all the great exercises were housed were in expert opinion level. And there's this huge disconnect. And as a clinician going into a DPT curriculum, and we need to give the students this evidence-based approach and evidence-based exercises, well, to tell a student that the highest level of exercise we have for an overhead athlete is 90 degrees of external rotation, arm at the side, it doesn't really match the message that we're trying to send as a contemporary clinician. So that simple concept led me to start to understand, why is there a big disconnect between what we do in the clinic and how it's looked at the highest levels, especially RCTs? And that's really when I wrote that paper. And it's funny, the reviewers and the journal editor were tweaking the title and were saying, hey, would you be okay tweaking the title a little bit? So we kept tweaking it and kept tweaking it, and it kept getting more controversial and more controversial.
I was just going to say, you're getting more in trouble. Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm like, well, that's not really what I'm trying to say. I mean, it is, but I'm not trying to stir the pot. And now looking back on it, I'm like, that's what makes great readership, right? It was all over Twitter. And
right.
So you're exactly right. You had to take a deep dive into the article. And I'm not suggesting people didn't come away with the deepest meaning of what I was trying to come across.
Well, come on, now Steve. That I mean, it's been... Twitter is all about knee-jerk reactions based on journal titles. We know that. Not everybody reads the whole article.
You know, and at my advanced age, Mike, and I laugh because I'm still learning social media, and I didn't really maybe appreciate that initially, and then I started to read all the comments, and people were contacting me, and they were basically making their comments off the title and the picture,
right?
Which was really kind of funny. And I'm like, well, that's really not the point I was trying to make, but it's I'm really happy with that article, actually. And the fact that it did create a conversation. There were a lot of people saying, someone had said I was excited to read it. And then when I read it, I was like, well, yeah, I kind of already do that. I already know that. So right. I don't think it was revolutionary in any sense. And you kind of alluded to that as well. When you read it, you were like, yeah, I kind of hear what you're saying. And I made a reference to a baseball player in the piece, but some people maybe didn't fully want to have this conversation about system tension and three-dimensional kinematics and, how this idea of stored elastic energy and propulsion. And these are really difficult concepts to try to tease out in a research method, and I fully appreciate that. And that's why it was only an editorial, but it really kind of kicked off the direction I wanted to go with my research was, is it possible to create these tension-related three-dimensional exercises that maybe hit several different constructs? And could we study that in more of an exploratory way with explanatory research, as opposed to this pragmatic design that says, let's just treat it like we would treat any patient walking in the clinic. Could we control for some variables and things like that? So I thought that piece really kicked off that conversation. And yeah, I definitely wasn't surprised for some of the comments that I got back. It definitely didn't make everyone very happy, but that's okay.
Well, it's super hard to develop a research article to specifically look at that. And gosh, I wish more people realized that, is that we cannot have finite answers to every question in the world. These research projects are impossible to develop. But, you brought up a great concept, that concept of tension-based dynamic valgus. Right. And I think that's sometimes what's missing, especially with some maybe early career professionals that are just hearing kind of conflicting sides of the story and maybe each end of the spectrum on social media. But it's not the position of valgus, but rather the amount of tension in that position. Valgus without tension, bad. right? Just put them in a, that's when you tear something, right? You get a forceful position, you know, maybe from, a traumatic accident, skiing, football, something like that. It's because you're in valgus without that tension. But if our goal is to control that movement and maintain tension, then all of a sudden, you know, maybe that's going to have some more carryover to some of those sporting events. So I thought that was amazing, right? Did I miss anything? Did I say anything poorly?
No, that was exactly it. And again, I think a lot of us as clinicians are already looking at it this way, are already trying to adapt to bringing tension into the rehab exercises. And I think what I was trying to say was, and I think the follow-up articles to that and eventually the research that I was able to collect through my research process, I think will shed some light onto that conversation, because some people would read it and then say, okay, so if it is tension dependent, or at least it's a construct that should be considered, should we be doing anything differently? Then should we be rehabbing them differently? Should we be screening them differently? Should be, you know, and I appreciated, you know, Amy Arundel's podcast that I listened to not long ago. I appreciated her approach when she was talking about mechanism of injury, and the Della Villa article that recently came out that talked about all the different ways the injury occurs and the mechanisms. And one of the highlighted sentences in that paper that really made me smile was, if you don't fully understand the mechanism, how could you potentially create exercises to address it? And I think I think we all look for our bias, right? So I was reading the article and I saw that and I was like, oh yeah, that speaks to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaks to me. Yeah. I like that one.
Well, I'd say, you know, that tension-based dynamic valgus, that was a really good thing that, you know, I thought you brought some attention to. The other one was, and I thought this was pretty cool, is the concept of this new term, pelvic pronation. Why don't you explain that to us? How do you define pelvic pronation? So that way, you know, if you're unfamiliar to that term, which I was when I first read it, I thought it was a great use of the phrase. But tell us more about pelvic pronation.
Yeah, it's also funny, when I tried to get that paper published, one of the editors or one of the reviewers rather said, this term, I've never heard it before. Does this really need to be in the paper? And it was one of the last edits I was making before publication. And it was a hill I was willing to die on. And I said, thank you for that.
Yes. Yeah.
They didn't want to put it in. And in some casual conversations with some bigger name researchers that have been mentors of mine, when I originally described the piece that I wanted to create, all of them had a very similar reaction. Like, that makes no sense. Like, why would you introduce a new term and cloud the arena with new terms? That's like the number one thing we shouldn't be doing. And I said, no, I appreciate that. But from a clinical standpoint, I've always felt like when we talk about foot pronation, we all conjure this immediate image of this three-dimensional kind of shock-absorbing method that your foot has to go through before propulsion. And you remember back in the day when we were rehabbing even knees and things like that, when we were looking at foot pronation was the devil. If you overpronated, like, that was you had to, let's go see an orthotist, and we had all kinds of issues, right? So we've developed and evolved that thought process. It's not as bad as it used to be, of course, but I think using that word pronation in that sense with the foot, really clinicians specifically will start to apply an exercise strategy that seems to be more three-dimensional. And if you look at the foot and how the foot works in terms of absorption to propulsion and creating this rigid lever in such a short period of time, when I was in hockey, I was starting to fully understand that this idea that the pelvis collapses three-dimensionally, very similar to the foot, and its job really is to absorb ground reaction force, get into a position after absorbing force to lock itself in a more kind of rigid position so it can do propulsion and create this lever. And I was seeing this unique relationship between the trunk and the pelvis, particularly in hockey players in the skating stride, and then started to understand that we do that in most all of our activities, is this three-dimensional wrapping. And the Takken Langhout of the Netherlands talked about this with soccer players and how tension arcs gets developed, and the elasticity is where some of the power comes from, which is really more maybe of a strength and conditioning and performance kind of understanding than it translates to rehab a lot of times. But the essence of pelvic pronation is, by definition, really, we used to use it jokingly when we worked with our players as a verb, and we would say you're going into flexion, adduction, internal rotation, and you're basically fadeering at your pelvis. And we dealt with a lot of course, internal hip impingements, FAI, and those kinds of things in the hockey population. And if you can't control your pelvis on a stable femur, once it drops into this three-dimensional collapse and goes into flexion, adduction, internal rotation, you get this impaction at the femur and the pubis and the acetabular rim. Now, if you couple that with what we're really familiar with, which is knee valgus, which is also adduction and internal rotation, you get this nice kissing lesion type response between the pelvis and the lower extremity. So we used to use it as a verb, and we used to say you're fadeering. Pelvic pronation are really similar concepts, and that's by definition, I think the way I describe it is this closed chain fadeering response.
I like that. I think that's a great way of phrasing it, and I think that term is going to be helpful for people. Before we get too far on this, because I like this concept on this 3D motion, right? Which makes sense. We have to control tension in multiple planes of motion. I've heard you talk about this reductionist lens approach that we've had in the past. We break down a complex task like skating, throwing, jumping, running, whatever it may be, and we put it into its individual pieces. And then oftentimes we just focus on those individual pieces and hope that when they all get put back together, things go great, right? I like that. But again, I see there's always these discussions and then people are too extremes and say, you always have to do it one way or you always have to do the other. I always think it's in the middle. But do you think this reductionist approach is always bad? Is there a time where maybe you have isolated weakness of one muscle that you want to work on that isolated approach? And then, you know, how do you then integrate that back up to more complex tasks?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mike. And I think that haunts us all as clinicians, right? You've got this orchestra playing in front of you, but you've got one instrument out of tune or can't keep up or whatever else. Can you pull that one instrument out, go give it to a coach, work them up, practice them up, and then put them back in the orchestra? Absolutely. I think we can do that. And eventually that person has to be able to keep up with the orchestra or it continually will be a problem. So this idea of reducing things down to one idea to work on, especially at the impairment-based level, is incredibly important and in the foundation of, I think, what we do as clinicians. I think it's our job to be able to identify who's that one wrong player in the orchestra and work on that very thing. So it has its place, and I'm not suggesting throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I do get pigeonholed, I think, sometimes as, you know, let's make everything more complex, let's make everything three-dimensional. And I've stumbled upon this idea of recursion, and they use recursion in different types of unrelated fields like mathematics and linguistics and all these other things. And recursion basically says it's something of it's a process of repeating items in a self-similar way. And that has really resonated with me, meaning can I still apply a strategy that will reflect that movement once it's back in the hole? And I think that's where I kind of like to live. And I think you kind of said it as well, somewhere in the middle, right? But it's the difference between finding, let's say, your piriformis is not doing a good job of stabilizing your pelvis and decelerating your femur and internal rotation during landing. Can we work on that in a reductionist manner, isolate it, maybe even do it in sidelying, and still maybe capture some of the motor control elements that are needed once you're back up on your feet? And I'm a little biased, obviously, the way the lens that I look through, but taking these concepts from people like Tack and Langhout that have showed us that trunk rotation ultimately alters hip position and hip range of motion. So we know that there's this three-dimensional connection. We've got evidence now supporting that. And I think clinically, anecdotally, we've always thought that, but we've got some evidence to move in that direction to create our exercises. So if you are doing a reductionist type exercise, can we use this a form of recursion to make this reductionist exercise look like what it might, kind of a task specific approach to whatever the final method might look like, and always trying to hang on to this recursion? So if you are going to reduce something down to its basic element, try to keep the motor control and the interplay of the rest of the orchestra moving in the same direction instead of making this isolated technique that looks nothing like how it would look once it's back in the full task specific way. And can we, in some of my research, I was really trying to answer that. Can we build capacity while gaining motor control at the same time.
Yeah. And when you put that together, that's when the magic tends to happen, right? I think sometimes people get in trouble when they're either too much of a reductionist or too much of a complicator, right? And the answer always lies in the middle. And that's one of the big, you know, principles that we use at Champion here is that, you know, if you have a weak muscle, it's going to have a really hard time stabilizing. Just to completely dumb down that phrase, right? Weak muscles can't stabilize. So you have to have a reductionist approach to get that back to its baseline. But then you also then have to take that up to that next level of complexity and how it integrates with their task. People are all the time on Instagram and social media. They're getting stuck in one of those two buckets and not seeing that you need them both and they both have to grow, right?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think it was, I listened to one of your other podcasts not long ago, and I think it was Dan Lorenz who said someone had mentioned to him, why are you not on Instagram? And he said, I would have the most boring Instagram account ever because I'm not doing the crazy. And that just resonated with me. I'm like, I love that comment because, you know, you got to do the basics well and nothing beats, you know, foundational strength and power and all these foundational elements of performance. All the fancy stuff can come later. I always wonder is, can we mix some of those, right, you know, more basic exercises in our rehab with a more complex approach?
Right. And that's what the expert clinician tends to do. And that's, you know, you'll get there if you're young and you're listening to this and you're there, it's okay. You'll get there. You'll start to see when they start blending more. I promise it's going to come. But Steve, you've alluded a couple times now to some of these articles you've published. You looked at some common exercise selection with pathology. So ACL injuries, patellofemoral pain, FAI. And what you're looking for are the common exercises that we see and we talk about and are published all the time, do they accurately reflect what's really happening with the pathomechanics of these injuries? Why don't you talk a little bit about that? I think we've already kind of covered a bit of this 3D complexity of the hip, and I'm sure that's where you're going to go with that. But tell us a little bit about those findings for ACL, patellofemoral, FAI, and essentially what you found in those articles.
Yeah, you're exactly right. There is a common theme between these different pathologies, and we look at the relationship between the pelvis and the lower extremity. And this isn't to diminish the impact of the foot and how ground reaction forces are mediated as it moves up the kinetic chain. I have just found my interest in my research area seems to be a little more proximal. But of course, moving even more proximally to the trunk and then even more distally to the foot's important. But we all know that there's a big injury burden with these pathologies, but they all have a very similar underlying component. And they all talk about these single leg ground impacts. And the interesting thing about the title in JOSPT's article about knee valgus, when we said controlling knee valgus, what do we really mean? We really mean, do you have the ability to eccentrically decelerate levers that are spinning under high speeds, high loads, very short periods of time? Do we have the ability to create interventions that can actually decelerate these levers? And that's what I really wanted to know. And you look back at that transition. Remember when we used to tape the patella? And I mean, we probably still do on some level, but, you know, probably not as much. But when we looked at the VMO insufficiency, and then things moved a little more proximally, and that Souza and Powers paper in 2010 looked at that MRI result of the femur kind of spinning internally under the patella, and maybe it's the track underneath the train that's the problem. And that kind of launched us in the direction of proximal control and how the hip controls knee position. And when you look at that original article and they show that MRI, the person stepping up into the MRI platform, and their females with patellofemoral pain have 2 times the internal rotation. And I just look at that and I say, and I saw this all the time in the hockey stride, and we're constantly trying to figure out how to decelerate this internal rotation coming from the pelvis and the femur. So we looked at all the exercises that are prescribed for these pathologies, maybe housing this kind of common pathomechanical mechanism that's occurring. So we started to pull all the exercises out, literally looking at every exercise under our inclusion criteria across these three injury mechanisms. And overwhelmingly, we came back, and I think the ACL one's the one I probably get the most questions on, but we looked at really 4 basic mechanisms that are reported in the literature: single limb landings, trunk pelvic dissociation. We looked at whether or not they can stabilize on a, is, are they landing on a flight phase on a single limb? And we wanted to see if these exercises reflected that deceleratory nature of the internal rotation of the and the adduction of the lower extremity. And what we found was less than 1% of the exercises. In the ACL paper specifically, it was over 1,000 exercises from a review as early as 1996. And the other interesting thing you'll really enjoy with that is when you looked at the exercises, each program, some of them had 4 exercises and some had 104. That was the highest one. So can you imagine doing an injury prevention program with 104 exercises? And you're pretty much just throwing everything at it and something's going to work.
Right.
And I think it's, you know, Mike, I think we have to be honest that we're doing a great job. You know, I think the researchers that have created these injury prevention programs, I'm not suggesting on any level that they're ineffective. They're very effective.
Right.
I think we all also agree is we don't know exactly why they're effective. So I'm looking at a really small portion of those injury prevention programs. Again, I'm not saying let's throw the baby out with the bathwater. What is happening and where the literature has gone over the last 25 years is pretty amazing. But one of the things I wanted to enter into the conversation is, do our exercises in a single leg landing replicate the deceleratory forces and speed that's occurring to maybe slow down this injury event? And I think those reviews clearly show that those exercises don't do that.
And I think this ties it all together with what we just previously talked about a little bit. There essentially were a reductionist lens to an extent, right? Let's come up with injury prevention and rehab programs that are very reductionist in nature. And to give them credit, they worked a little or somewhat or fair enough, right? There is some efficacy of taking it that way. But the complex task in hand still missing is probably that missing link that we're having from having exceptional results, right? And that I think that's what I thought of when I read your papers, and I even reflect back at my own programs that I write for people and we work with people. We have to build that in a little bit more. So taking a reductionist approach and working the components helps, and it's a step in the right direction. We have to do that, but we could probably do better, right? So it sounds like what you're saying here is we need to get more complex. We need to get more 3D. We need to start putting that all together. Any suggestions on how clinicians can start thinking that way and maybe some exercise tips for them? How can we start improving our exercise selection for these things then?
Yeah, this is where we're stepping from the evidence-based realm into the evidence-informed realm, which some people listening to this podcast are going to be immensely offended that we're suggesting that, you know, these things don't work. With a 50% reduction with some of these programs, I mean, they're certainly working. Yes.
They work. Yes.
Exactly. So you should be doing something, and there's enough out there now to help us. But as Amy alluded to in her podcast, she said, the best we've gotten down to are buckets. We know you should be doing some proximal control. We know you should be doing some plyometrics. We know you should be doing some strengthening. Underneath that, what goes into those and what they exactly look like has not really been teased out yet.
Right.
So, and that's where I think I was trying to go, was saying, okay, first and foremost, is there a reason we should even be looking at this, or have we figured it out? Do we know enough that these programs, doesn't matter what exercises you put in them, as long as you house them in these buckets, you'll be fine. And I think there's probably an optimization process there still waiting. I still think that. But to be fully transparent, your question hints to someone listening that researches the ACL every day saying, why is this guy suggesting you should do exercises this way when there's no evidence clearly to support why you're saying develop an exercise that way? And one thing I've learned through the process of trying to develop a line of research is you really have to start by understanding the landscape of what's out there, trying to determine if there is a small space for a new need, and then going down the road to try to go through the painful process of trying to tease it out to see if it's effective. So I think it's clear and fair and transparent to offer that. Now, that said, where I went trying to bridge some of these conversations from the JOSPT piece to some of my actual experiments, and to answer your question specifically, is I was trying to develop exercises that would perturb the trunk, which is what we see as a high level of injury mechanisms. Although a lot of these injuries are non-contact, when you look at like Delavilla's work, he mentions that perturbation to the trunk prior to injury is not unusual. So we know that the trunk plays a big portion, but it's not really well represented in prevention programs. So what I was trying to do is think about taking a rope and spinning it around a top, pulling that rope and then watching the top spin on the tabletop. That's essentially what I was trying to do. I was trying to develop this idea of potential energy through the trunk, and would that rotation along the Z-axis, this potential energy, would it turn into a kinetic energy upon single limb landing and force someone to go into dynamic knee valgus? And if I could do that, would I prompt a capacity building response to the resistance? And would I develop a motor control response in a very short period of time that would make a connection between the brain and the limb to say, this needs to slow down. This spinning of the femur and pelvis need to slow down immediately up upon impact. And that's what I was trying to do. And that's what I was trying to measure when I conducted my experiments. And I used Ali Gokler's work to talk about this idea of training dyads and using external feedback between teammates. Could I watch your knee mic while you were doing a single leg landing and give you some three-dimensional and global feedback while I was tethering you at the trunk to spin you off balance? And could I use that trunk perturbation to help you control your three-dimensional position upon landing? And that's really the training method, what I was going under. And there were several other exercises that I was able to develop along this process to determine, okay, they house all the elements of injury mechanism. Now let's measure them in a very specific way, as pragmatically as possible. And like you said, one of your first comments was, I wish people better understood how hard that actually is.
Exactly. I would almost argue it's impossible to do, but kudos to you for trying, you know, and yeah, I mean, if people didn't have these evidence-based or evidence-informed questions, then we would never have evidence-based practice going forward, right? So we have to keep pushing that envelope. I think it's great that we have some evidence that these programs work, but we've all had patellofemoral pain patients that don't get better. We've all had FAIs that we can't fix non-operatively that they end up having surgery. We all have ACLs that do get injured even though they went through an injury prevention program. But how can we make that better? And I think you're really pushing the envelope with some of those things to improve them. So awesome stuff, Steve. I love it. Great episode. I hope a lot of people can kind of dig into your research. Check out the show notes in this episode. Before I let you go, we got to get our high five in. So five quick questions, five quick answers coming from you, so we can learn a little bit about you, how your mind thinks, your growth mindset, stuff like that. But first question, what are you, Steve, currently working on yourself for your own professional development?
Ooh, that's a pretty boring answer. I recently defended my PhD, and I was given a whole host of edits to address. So I will be busy
terrible.
Over the next. Yeah, I would. I'll be busy over the next several months, just trying to make edits on my dissertation and get that finally submitted and off my plate. So that's the fire that's on in front of me right now.
Yeah, that's a huge fire too. So I like that one. And you know, this episode I think may partly answer some of this question, but what's one thing that you've recently changed your mind or evolved your thoughts on?
Oh, the one interesting conversation I had recently about, especially when we talk about evolving my thoughts, I was listening to a JOSPT podcast with Steve Camper. I think he's in Australia, and he does that segment on evidence in practice. And he breaks down these really complex ideas about research for really simple explanations. But he goes on this tangent about what is evidence-based practice. And he talks about that. And I think that he's convinced me to maybe change my mindset a little bit. You know, we have this three-legged stool example of clinical experience, evidence in that's published and what your patient's expectations are. And then he goes, if you haven't listened to it yet, check him out on the podcast, but he talks about how evidence really is more than just published papers. And he gives his rationale as to why that is. And if we could just figure out a mechanism to understand the bias in everything outside of published research and a model to create that, we'd have much more information to draw from.
Yeah, that's gigantic. I love it. Well, you deal with this a lot, but what's your biggest piece of advice that you give students that you work with?
You know, one of the first things I learned this in our corporate positions when we worked way back when was someone had once told me, no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So gaining these credentials and letters after your name is great, and pursuing all these advanced clinical options is great. But be a clinician at heart. Understand what it is to be a good clinician and treat your patients right. Ask good clinical questions. And even though if you don't have the answers, your patients will give you a lot of respect for everything and all the effort you do to try everything in your power to make them better. And then, of course, seek out people like yourself. I mean, people that are really out there. I give people like you so much credit, Mike. You're out on the front lines. You've mastered kind of the social media and the learning-based experiences online. It's fantastic. And students need to take advantage of all those things and find the right mentors to follow along as they build their clinical careers.
Awesome. Thank you for that. What's coming up next for you, Steve?
Well, once I put this PhD to bed and get that off my plate, I learned a lot through that process. And just like anything, once you do it for the first time and becoming an early clinical scientist, I've refined some of my questions, I've refined some of my methods, and I'd actually like to start another data collection with everything I've learned up to this point, maybe make some corrections to some of the things I didn't consider the first time around. And like anything, the next time you do it, you're probably a little better at it. So I'm looking actually forward to developing some new studies.
That's awesome. Sweet. And where can we learn more about you? Is there a place that you tend to call home? Do you have a website, social media? Where can people go to find out more about you and your research?
I do. There's not a lot out there. Still working on my website. My website's Finish First PT, like Finish First Physical Therapy, but it's Finish First PT. My social media handles, I'm kind of like Dan, I don't have any post on my social media account on my Instagram. I haven't quite got there yet. I do have a Twitter account that I try my best to stay up with, but it's Finish First _PT, like physical therapy. And that's where you can find me. And please reach out if you have any questions or if you have anything disparaging to say about the JOSPT piece, throw it out there and we can banter it around.
Exactly. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, awesome. Thanks again, Steve. I really appreciate it. I'll put those links in the show notes so people can head and find out more about you. Thanks again for taking time out to do this podcast episode today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please share this with your friends to help spread the word. It would really mean so much to me. Please check out all my online courses, articles, newsletter, and more at mikerano.com. There's always a ton of great perks for my newsletter subscribers. And also be sure to search for my other podcast, The Ask Mike Reinold Show, where my team of physical therapists, strength coaches, and I answer your questions. See you on the next episode.